Hello and welcome to Bondcast, a podcast series where we discuss our views on the latest themes and events shaping rates markets. I'm Imogen Makra, head of non-dollar rate strategy, and I'm joined today by our global market specialist, Jan Nivruzzi. Jan, I think we should kick off with you because it felt like all eyes this week were waiting for US inflation data. In the end, perhaps not as much of a market mover as we were expecting it to be, but can you just kind of go through what your key takeaways are after that print?
Sure, yeah. I think you pointed at it that it was not such a market mover. I would say on the margin, markets took it in a little bit of a hawkish ride because the headline number, which includes energy and energy and food, was 0.4, which you would expect. But consensus for the core side, which excludes food and energy, was at 0.3. The actual number came at 0.4, but you look into the details, it's actually 0.358. So it's a very, very soft 0.4. That's a deceleration from the January pace. It was a stronger number, but we talked about this in the past couple of weeks in the podcast too, that January and February tend to display this, even seasonally, on a season adjusted basis, like a acceleration almost in inflation that tends to kind of fizzle away in March and onward. So we actually did get some of that. And looking a little bit within the components, and I promise I'm not going to dig too deep, but just to separate the core services side and the core goods side, core services actually inched down to 0.5 month on month. That's compared to like 0.7 in January. So that's trending in the right direction. Some of the improvement there was seen in the shelter side. So again, we had something unusual of rent measure and the OER, owner's equivalent rent, which is a metric that the BLS uses to basically gauge rent from people who own their homes, right? Because a large portion of the country owns their homes. Those moved in different directions, which is highly unusual. Again, not to bore listeners with a lot of the kind of technical calculation details, but that was largely a sampling issue. What was also different this time was the goods component within inflation. So what we look at as like core goods actually was positive for the first time after a string of monthly decline. So we've actually been in an environment of deflation for core goods, not even disinflation. So that increased, some of it driven by things like used cars, apparel, like educational commodities and such that turned that subcomponent positive, but it wasn't, its contribution to core CPI is effectively zero, like very, very close to negligible. It's still services where the problem or like the accelerated pace is, but one of the reassuring sides is that the shelter measures are now trending towards what we observe from new market indices. We're pretty confident that inflation is on path to 2%, but post that, markets did reprice a little bit. We've scaled back the expectations for interest rate cuts this year. I think that's understandable, even though a lot of people who close track CPI know that this is likely to decelerate in the coming months, or what we've seen over the past 2 months is likely to kind of give away in the next couple of months. We've been, markets have been really overreacting to the spot data, and until you kind of get that certainty, it's hard to kind of ignore it as a one-off.
I think it would be remiss of us to talk about US CPI this week without giving a quick shout out to our US economist, Deepika, who actually called it to 3 decimal points.
That's right. Yeah, I should have done that.
Which is a very impressive call. Okay, so we had CPI other data this week. Of course, that sets up nicely for the Fed next week. It is one of their kind of quarterly meetings with updated projections and updated dot plot. What are you watching for in that meeting?
So let's focus on the three main components that I think will be important. First, rates as widely expected unchanged. There's virtually 0% chance unless something goes massively wrong between now and the meeting. Actually, even the statement, we don't really expect any major tweaks there. So let's just lump the interest rate and the statement into one category of things that will remain unchanged. Something that could change, but we think is not going to, is the Fed's forecast. We get the quarterly SEP forecast that include the forecasts on inflation, growth, various other metrics. including where FOMC officials see interest rates ending this year, next year, the year after, in the longer term. At the December submission, the median, I guess, median voter saw 3 rate cuts in 2024. We still think that will stay at 3 rate cuts, but I do see it as a pretty close call. It's going to be almost a toss-up between going from 75 to 50, because data hasn't been overwhelmingly strong. They're aware of the intricacies in inflation, but that also hasn't been weak. So and you only need 2 officials to shift their or at least pare back the expectations for interest rate cuts for that to move. And that's a vague forecast, but still, if it happens, I think markets will gravitate towards that. That's why, this morning when we were kind of talking around on the desk, my view is that we probably started kind of lingering towards that mid-range between 50 and 75, as opposed to what was now, until now we used to be at like 75 to 100. I think that's kind of shifting into the other direction. I think we'll continue. Continue as we get closer to the meeting. We'll see if they actually will end up kind of lowering, but our official base case for now is for them to stay at, leave their forecast for 2024 unchanged. And finally, what will change at this meeting? The third point is discussions about on quantitative tightening and the future of on the balance sheet. We've already been alluded from by Chair Powell, by a couple of other FOMC officials to that. We will get a much more granular look into how they're going to approach the future of quantitative tightening and the balance sheet. For one, I'm looking for some more details around what the phrase of ample reserves might mean, right? Like it's generally tossed around as a pretty vague statement. Let's see if they quantify it a little bit. Let's see what type of money market spreads they will be gauging to get like a feeling of how far is too far. Right now, there really isn't anything in money markets that screams there's tightness in cash or there's any liquidity crunch. If anything, the complete opposite. Things have eased up a little bit since the end of last year. So we will get a lot more on the balance sheet. And after we kind of get those details, I'll be able to kind of have a much better forecast of when the Fed is likely to end quantitative tightening. So far, we expect June for that announcement, but the odds of an announcement in June to have QT running only at half pace have increased substantially as well. So that's it on the Fed. No rate change. To summarize quickly, no rate change, no change in statement, no change in the dots, but risks of upside shift for this year and an in-depth discussion of quantitative tightening and the balance sheet rundown process going forward. And with that, I'm going to wrap up the U.S. Joanne's out today, so you have the honor of covering both the U.K. and Europe, but let's start with you. We also have the BOE next week, so if you could just kind of run through what you expect.
Yeah, I think the very short answer is that we really don't expect anything at all from the Bank of England meeting next week. Unlike the Fed, it isn't a kind of quarterly forecast round. So we won't get any updated projections. And of course, for the BOE, that means there won't be a press conference after the decision is published. So it really feels very much like a placeholder meeting. There was a shift in the guidance at the last meeting, if we remember, where, Bailey was clear that the rhetoric around the policy path in the BOE was shifting from not how restrictive do we need rates to get to, but they're now restrictive enough, and how long do we have to stay at this restrictive level? Since then, we've had data that you would probably argue at the margin has leaned a little bit more dovishly, but BOE speak has stuck very closely to the script of, data evolving as they would hope, but they need more evidence that inflation is getting sustainably back to their 2% target. And only once they have that, more evidence will we see a change in the policy rate. So it feels far too early, again, in that context, to be expecting any sort of change from the Bank of England next week. We actually have unchanged rates, unchanged forward guidance, and probably an unchanged vote as well next week, which will be the most unchanged Bank of England meeting in a while, I think. Probably the biggest thing to watch or where that could be wrong is most likely to be on the vote. If you remember at the last meeting, we had Dingra voting for a cut, Catherine Mann and Haskell voting for a hike, and then the six other members voting for unchanged rates. So it's possible that we see, you know, either both or one of Haskell or Mann folding into the unchanged rates category. You know, Mann, the kind of leading hawk on the committee, previously said that her decision to vote for a hike was quite finely balanced. And like I say, the data has evolved a little bit more dovishly since then. But I don't think that that is really all that important in determining the kind of future policy path. You know, I guess it's always useful to know what the most hawkish or the most dovish members of the committee thinks to kind of create those back markers. But really, for the BOE to get closer to cutting rates, you need that kind of central five or six members to be leaning more in favour of rate cuts. And we just aren't there yet. You know, I think we can consider Bailey and Pill as two of the kind of leaders of that central faction of the committee, and they have both, like I say, been quite clear since the last meeting that yes, data is evolving as they would like to see it, but they just need to see more of it. So all in, probably a very unexciting meeting next week, I think, and we don't expect it, you know, given that we expect largely everything to be unchanged. Don't expect it to be particularly market moving, or to change our base case that we think that the first cut will come in August, and we expect 100 basis points of easing to be delivered this year.
Well, we do have some key data this week and also CPI next week in the UK as well. Do you think that's going to matter at all for the BOE and then for the markets?
Yeah, like I said, I think, you know, broadly speaking, you would characterize that all of the data that, not all, on balance, the data that we've had since the last BOE meeting as at the margin a bit more dovish than expected. And I think both the labor market data this week and the GDP data this week kind of fall into that category. Of course, GDP rebounded slightly higher than expected, but a lot of that was driven by one-off factors, a rebound in the wholesale retail output sector, which saw a big fall in the previous month, and, you know, probably what we would consider an unsustainably large rise in construction output. So it looked like a somewhat strong number on the surface, but digging into the detail, it wasn't really that robust. And actually, if you take a kind of longer term view, we're still talking about a backdrop of stagnation when it comes to UK growth. On the labour market side, the wage data is clearly the most important here. There's still lots of question marks around the labour force survey data. And so the wage data is what becomes most important, I think, in that set of data. We saw another month of gradual declines in average weekly earnings. That's important because, A, this was January data. January is the second most important month of the year when it comes to the wage setting process in the UK. So to make it kind of through that month, A, without big firework, well, a big upside surprise on the number, and B, without big upside revisions to previous months is important. But B, also probably encouraging in that this month's data suggests that to get an overshoot now of the BOE's Q1 projections for wage inflation looks quite unlikely. And in fact, an undershoot of the BOE's projections is perhaps more likely. So it feels to me really like the message from the data this week and in what we've had since the last BOE meeting is that, you know, one of data that's trending in the right direction, but we still need to see more of that data for the BOE to be confident about cutting rates. We've spoken previously about how I think you would probably criticize the BOE at times last year for being too reactive to spot inflation. And arguably now their reaction function has shifted, or spot data, I should say, away from being reactive to spot data and now being reactive to the way which they see the skew of risks. And for a long time, they saw those risks as skewed quite clearly to the upside on the inflation side of things. And I think the more that we get better behaved data like we've had over the last couple of weeks, the more that you're concerns about those upside risks are diminished. And I think the more confident you become that the BOE actually can cut rates this year, still not perhaps as much as the market was expecting when we entered the year with that, you know, kind of 160-ish basis points of rate cuts being priced in. But I think you do, you know, with every month that goes by with, you know, relatively well-behaved data in the UK, the more confident that you are that the BOE's kind of implicit signaling of 75 to 100 basis points of easing this year is what's going to materialize. As you said, we get CPI next week. We expect that to tell a very similar story. We have headline and core inflation coming off again next month. But perhaps more importantly for the BOE, we see, also see another, not another, we see a step down in services inflation compared to a tick up last month. So again, another set of data, which is kind of encouraging, trending in the right direction, et cetera, et cetera. So for markets, I think, like I say, this kind of removes some of the upside risk when it comes to, you know, the possibility that the Bank of England isn't able to cut rates this year, or that we get another spike up in inflation, which delays that easing cycle. We've repriced so far now in the UK that actually I would say we're at the more kind of hawkish end of a reasonable range of expectations. The market's only looking for 70 bips now of easing this year, which feels low. Like I say, our sort of central scenario is 100 basis points. And the distribution of those cuts looks off to me. You know, the market's almost universally expecting that the BOE can get off the mark in August, yet only has 50 basis points of easing priced in the second half of the year. And I think if they are able to begin easing monetary policy by August, then we're more likely than not to see more than 50 basis points. So I would expect to see more easing in the second half of this year than the market is currently pricing in. For the rest of the curve, you know, that's really being driven by monetary policy expectations as well. And so the extent to which you see that upside risk or those concerns around pushing that policy pivot further into the future, perhaps remove some of the upside risk on yields. I've kind of previously been saying that I wouldn't fade the cheapening in 10-year gilts until they got to 420 or 430 kind of range. And maybe that range actually becomes more like 410 to 420, let's say, if we think about domestic kind of data alone. Although, as we've seen this week and really over the last couple of weeks, bank rate pricing and gilt yields feel driven by a lot of what is going on elsewhere. And it feels very much like markets perceive that global central banks are kind of in the Fed slipstream. So perhaps all of this becomes redundant and really all that matters next week is the Fed. But let's see.
I'm going to switch over gears a little bit towards Europe. And because the ECB finalized their operational framework review this week, can you kind of give us the main takeaways from that?
Yeah, we've heard lots from the ECB this week, but it feels to me like anyone that we hear really from whatever kind of side of the hawk dove spectrum they are on, they're all repeating a very similar message now that June is, you know, the most likely time for a cut, which is exactly what we heard from Lagarde last week. So it feels a little bit like ECB speak has become redundant this week. And then, as you say, that leaves the conclusion of the operational framework review as the kind of ECB highlight this week. We were really watching for four things, two of which I guess I'll start with which could have been the more market moving elements, although in the end, neither of those were delivered. So the first was a change to the minimum required reserves. Currently, the ECB requires banks to hold 1% essentially of their short term deposits at the ECB, which are remunerated at 0%. We had thought that could be increased to 2%. In part to kind of save the ECB's interest bill, given that they pay the deposit rate on those reserves that are held at the ECB, on excess reserves, I should say. But there was a sources article last week that suggested that it would be held at 1% rather than increased. And in the end, that's exactly what was delivered. So there was no change on MRR. And then the second, perhaps more market moving element that might have been tweaked was on the remuneration of government deposits. Currently, the ECB remunerates those at ESTA minus 20 bips. But we had thought that they might move to be more in line with the Bundesbank, which remunerate them at zero. And again, in the end, that didn't materialize. I think there are the two elements that would have had the more immediate market moving impact. The big change that was announced was around its liquidity providing facilities. So the whole point of this operational framework review, I suppose, was to ensure that the kind of financial plumbing of money markets works properly as the ECB shrinks its balance sheet and reserves shrink in tandem with that as QT and TLTRO loans mature. So as it stands in the euro area at the moment, you can borrow reserves through the marginal lending facility, but previously they were charged quite a punitive rate at the deposit rate facility plus 50 basis points. And as expected, that 50 basis point spread has now been reduced to 15 basis points, which helps the provision of reserves at a level closer to the deposit rate facility and avoids that kind of fall in reserves as we get closer to, you know, what we might consider a world of reserve scarcity, putting undue upward pressure on money market rates. For anyone that's kind of familiar with the plumbing of the system in the UK, that means that the ECB have adopted what we would call a demand-driven approach, very much like the BOE have. And this new facility looks much more similar to the BOE's short-term repo facility, for example. Of course, that was very much as expected, and we're still a long way from the point at which we might consider ourselves to be an environment of reserve scarcity, let's say in the euro area. So the point at which this might bite or might matter is still a long way off. And I think that was reflected, both of those things, the fact that it was as expected and it, you know, the point at which this matters is still a long way away was reflected in the lack of market moves. And then finally, we were just looking for anything that might give us a hint about the kind of steady state size or structure of the ECB's balance sheet going forwards. They did talk about this idea of having a structural bond portfolio and having a long-term structural liquidity facility, but there wasn't really any insights offered on that, so we have to wait for kind of further conclusions on what both of those might look like. But all in, I would describe it as another kind of risk event over the past week, which markets were eagerly anticipating, but in the end passed without any fireworks, as the end result was very close to expectations, much like much of the data last week. Okay. That's enough from me. Let's stop there. Hopefully Joanne's back next week. I didn't have to wear my non-dollar hat for too long. Thank you, listeners, for listening in. Thank you, Jan, for joining me. We'll catch up next week after the BOE and the Fed. So we'll see if our unchanged forecasts were in fact correct. Just a reminder, if you liked today's episode, please don't forget to hit the like button and click subscribe so you can get the latest episodes as soon as they're available. Thanks. See you next week.